And a great countdown lined up today. My guests on the countdown include Tim Hixt. He is, I always say your name wrong, Tim.
No, you said it perfectly.
Okay, terrific. Tim Hixt is the Chief Technology Officer at AgileX and joining me in studio. And you've chosen three great stories, and I'm looking forward to counting them down today.
So much.
And my other guest is my colleague, Federal News Radio Executive Editor Jason Miller. It's good to see you. Thanks for being on.
It's always a pleasure to count them down.
Yeah, it always, people give me a hard time when you're on the countdown sometimes because they say, well, he's just going to come on and choose. But I always enjoy having you here because your insights are very, very good. And you know what's going on in this market so well. So it's
great. Thank you. And it's always fun.
It is indeed. We start, of course, as we always do with
number three.
The third most important federal news story of the week is chosen by Tim, is headlined, Evidence Suggests the Internet Changes How We Remember. It's from Technology Review. I saw this earlier in the week, and this is literally how our brains are wired being changed by the things that we do online.
Yeah, so as a technology guy, I was a little leery that this would be interesting to people, and then I saw that it also was in the Post this morning, so they came up with the same study. So I guess it has a little bit more broad interest than I'd feared. The idea is pretty straightforward. We all think about the fact that we have ubiquitous access to information, and so we don't have to remember what movies Nicolas Cage was in. We'll just go look it up when the time comes. But there's been no real empirical evidence of that. And so what these studies are showing is that now they've determined that maybe the way our brain works starts to change when we know that the answers are available somewhere else. We don't have to bother wasting any cycles remembering something because we know we can look it up. This has always been good for me because my brain is a figure things out kind of a brain, not a remember things kind of a brain.
Yes.
And so I like depending on knowing that it's there. The reason I think this is maybe important in our space, we spend a lot of time building mobile systems. And as we think about now these information sources getting to mobile workers so ubiquitously that now maybe as these tools improve, they can spend their mental cycles thinking on critical issues rather than distracted by remembering the details.
Rote information,
and this research is starting to suggest that maybe it even can improve your thinking in that regard. So
I was fascinated by this story because my family on my wife's side is all educators. My wife, both her parents, her sister, there's a tradition of that, and discussions about learning and how people learn are very common at family gatherings. And this is something that we've talked about any number of times. And that especially former colleagues of my father-in-law, who was a principal, have talked about this in the old kind of curmudgeonly get off my lawn manner, which is the kids these days, they don't have to know anything. They look everything up, and there's no such thing as remembering and memorizing dates, times, and so on. And my thought is, if you don't need to have in your brain the actual words of the Gettysburg Address or Pythagorean theorem or something like that, if you can look it up and apply that knowledge and clear your brain space for information that allows you to be creative and do something with the things that you're allowed to look at, seems to make a lot of sense to me.
Well, hopefully we still read the Gettysburg Address.
Right.
And hopefully we still take some mental cycles to interpret it, understand its historical context, know what it means. But you're right. I don't have to worry about memorizing it.
And you'll have the room to understand and comprehend it and apply it in your brain because we are starting to understand there's only a certain amount of space until other stuff starts getting pushed out.
But I would even argue that it's less about memorization, but it's just a part of the evolution. I mean, if you think about kids, and Francis, I know you guys were talking about your son earlier. Kids are learning differently. The digital native idea. Then, because they are so used to sitting down at the computer, using the mouse like it was second nature, and you still have people who are in the three generations behind them will learn differently. I think that's part of it. I don't think it's necessarily a change in person, but it's a change in the culture and what's important. And 150 years ago, it was important to memorize the Gettysburg Address because that's all there, there was no way to know about it.
That shift, I think, is important. My boss always gives me grief because he's like, you can't be well educated because you can't name all the state capitals or you can't, don't know what the you know, the population of Germany is, because he had to memorize all those things when he was in school.
Mm-hmm.
And I was in a transitionary period, I think, when I was in school, whereas there was some memorization,
yeah.
there was some not. But our kids are not at all. It's really just a focus on the thinking and rely on the sort of resources to remember.
My grandmother used to give me a dollar if I could name all the presidents of the United States in consecutive chronological order.
And there you go.
And back then, it was worth a lot more.
Well, that's true. It was. It'd be about $6 now, probably. Tim's number three story in the countdown this week is headlined, Evidence Suggests That the Internet Changes How We Remember, and you can read it at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. Jason Miller's story number three is from GovExec. The headline is, Federal Protective Service Struggles with New Management Tools, and they're certainly not the only agency. This is, I mean, you could probably walk into just about every agency, large or small, across government, and there are management issues.
Well, what stood out to me about this hearing, then? There was the House Oversight and Government Reform Committee, when the subcommittees held a hearing about the Federal Protective Service, and it was basically an update saying, where are they now? Have they made progress? And what was fascinating about this was they haven't made as much progress as one would think. GAO, again, you know, said, listen, you still have the same problems you had last year. What are you doing about it? And one really interesting part in the story talks about the head of the FPS, Patterson, and he says, yes, where our new system has failed. It has not done what we wanted to do. At the same time, he said, but we still protect 9,000 federal employees in 50 states. We have 1 million people pass through our what they call the portals each day. We make 1,600 arrests annually. So they're still doing their job. They're still protecting federal buildings. Could it be better protection? Yes. And what struck me is they just haven't made it better yet, or it hasn't been better in the sense where GAO can say, yes, it's gone from 50 to 75 or 80 to 100. And I think that's what the Congress and I think GAO is looking for.
The significance that I thought here, too, especially with the tone and listening to a little bit of this hearing from the chairman of the subcommittee, Dan Lundgren of California, is I'm sensing on both sides of the aisle, we're starting to get to the point where some of the members are saying, this is ridiculous. This can't continue, and somebody's going to have to be accountable. We can't just have a hearing every year where you come in, we yell at you a little bit when you say that nothing's changed, and nothing's changed.
I think that's absolutely right. And I think that there's some legislation that tried to get pushed through the Federal Protective Service Improvement Act or something, an update to their laws to actually move away from contractor security guards and move to full-time. And I'm wondering now what's going to happen with the budget deficit and the cuts in discretionary spending that we're hearing about that's coming. Is that all of a sudden going to say, whoa, maybe we don't have enough money to bring on extra guards, and the setup we have now, we have enough money for, but if there's a higher cost or a different cost, maybe we don't have that money.
Jason Miller, story number three in the countdown is headline, Federal Protective Service Struggles with New Management Tools. It's at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. All the stories that we're doing on the countdown this week with Jason Miller and Tim Hext of Agilex, both posted there right now. And we'll be back for story number two when In-Depth with Francis Rose continues on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
Going.
The job market's tight. I mean, I can barely get an interview,
yeah.
And I've got student loans to deal with. You're lucky, you know? The National Guard paid your loans off.
Luck? The Guard was a smart decision, one you can still make.
The National Guard Student Loan Repayment Program can pay up to $50,000 of your existing student loans. Get the details at NationalGuard.com.
Sponsored by the D.C. National Guard, aired by the Maryland, D.C. Delaware Broadcasters Association and this station.
The Government IT Solutions Spotlight is brought to you by CDWG.
Agencies are getting some cybersecurity help in their move to the cloud. Earl Crane is the director of the Cybersecurity Division in the Homeland Security Department's Chief Information Officer's Office. He is leading a CIO Council effort to develop guidelines detailing the top 20 cloud security considerations agencies should keep in mind. DHS is among the first agencies moving to public and private cloud services. It plans to put email, collaboration, and websites there over the next year.
If you're in federal IT, you know that every internet connection and every mobile device poses a threat to your data. Visit cdwg.com/security to learn how our security experts use the latest technology to help keep your agency ahead of those threats. CDWG. People who get it.
Visit CDWG.com to learn how you can achieve the benefits of private clouds with a VCE V-Block solution from EMC, Cisco, and VMware.
I'm on a mission to spread the word about COPD through music. COPD stands for chronic obstructive pulmonary disease. My grandfather suffered from symptoms of it, and COPD is the fourth leading cause of death in the U.S. I'm Billy Ray Cyrus, and I drive for COPD. Looks like people are starting to get the message. Anyone age 35 and older who has smoked as little as 100 cigarettes could be at risk. Visit driveforcopd.com today and talk to your doctor.
It's the only program of its kind in the world. A unique opportunity to help strengthen our country's defense and further your career. The National Defense Executive MBA at George Mason University's School of Management. The only executive MBA degree tailored to developing leaders and managers in the U.S. defense industry. A unique combination of high-caliber executive business education, defense industry-specific knowledge, and hands-on learning designed to accelerate your career in the military, government, and corporate defense sectors. All without the career interruption of a traditional degree. Learn more at som.gmu.edu/defense. That's som.gmu.edu/defense. Do it today because the last day to apply for the fall semester is July 15th. The National Defense Executive MBA at George Mason University, helping our country's defense, advancing your career.
I'm Amy Morris. Here's a look at Monday morning's Federal Drive. We're learning more about how many people work for the government. Turns out the Labor Department's latest numbers show federal, state, and local government jobs are on the decline. And how can you tell just how much money the Defense Department is spending and on what? We'll hear from Congressman Robert Andrews in our Congressional Spotlight. That and more Monday morning starting at 6 on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
Federal News Radio in a Web 2.0 world. Find Federal News Radio on Facebook and Twitter. Follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/FedNewsRadio or join the Federal News Radio group on Facebook. Chat with our team and make connections with others in the federal arena. Email us at fnrcomment@federalnewsradio.com. Visit our website, federalnewsradio.com. Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, your source for federal news now.
We're back on In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. It's the Federal News Countdown with Tim Hext of Agilex and Jason Miller, my colleague here at Federal News Radio on the Countdown. We're up to
number two.
And Jason Miller's story number two on the Countdown this week is agencies slowly moving to fixed price contracts. And the story, coincidentally, by Jason Miller on FederalNewsRadio.com.
I just want to point out only one this week by me.
Okay. All right. The other one. Okay. We'll get into that later. Agencies moving to fixed price contracts means specifically what? Not for how they're doing it, but what are the implications?
Well, what I thought, this was a report from the Office of Federal Procurement Policy that actually Dan Gordon kind of gave us a little preview last week when he announced the campaign to cut waste, the latest attempt on cutting the number of management support service contracts. But basically what this comes down to is the administration is saying that time and materials contracting and labor hours contracts are high risk to the government, and agencies should only use those if absolutely positively necessary. So they should move to more a firm fixed price type contract, which companies like Agilex, they can assume the risk versus the government. Mm-hmm. So what this report shows is that, yes, agencies actually are moving away from time and materials and labor hours and what they call other cost reimbursement type contracts, and saying to companies like Agilex, saying, well, how much will this cost for you to do this for us? And Agilex or any company says, $5. And the government says, okay, I'll pay you $5. If it costs them $4, that means Agilex makes a profit more than they expected. If they cost them $7, then Agilex loses money. But either way, the government is less risky. And this is very interesting because this is something the administration has been pushing for a couple of years now. And we're starting to actually see some real results. $1 billion less spent on time and materials labor hour contracts between 2009 and then in 2010.
What effect does the type of contract have, if any, on the innovation and the development of new things for government from the companies. And are they connected at all?
Well, I think so, yeah. The challenge we have with this, first, we see this as a cyclical change. The government starts to say we want to not have all these cost overruns, so we want to go firm fixed price, but then maybe they get change ordered to death, and then they say, well, now we're going to go back to time. And so there is a bit of a cyclical nature in this. Mm-hmm. But from our perspective, the challenge is, in your example, when you said, oh, they could ask Agilex, you know, what will it cost for me to do this? What is this? And if I'm defining that up front is what it's all about.
Mm-hmm.
And so to your question about how does that change the way we think about how we innovate in the context of it, defining requirements for a system up front with such clarity that it allows us to understand the risks that we're taking on to do this is very difficult in IT. Mm-hmm. If I'm building a bridge,
yeah,
then I know it's got to go from here to here. It's got to support this much weight. I can define the requirements. But a system that they're not even sure exactly what they wanted to do, that all gets figured out along the way, it makes this much more complicated.
But I think, though, on the other hand, mm-hmm. the other piece of this is there are certain things you do know what's going to cost you. Mm-hmm. You do know what help desk services are going to cost you. You do know what, if you will, hey, I need some help with writing reports or doing acquisition planning. You do know what those are. And if you do it on a time and materials basis, the vendor has this reputation, and I'm not sure if it's a fair reputation or not, to nickel and dime the government to death. Well, this is going to take me an hour. I'll push it to an hour and a half, so I get that little bit extra money. And all of a sudden, the government thought they'd spend $5 million on the support services, and then they're spending $7 million because the vendor, and it may not always be the vendor's fault, but at least the reputation is that they're getting they're
the perception is that kind of contract leaves it open for the vendors to be able to do that.
Right, but the challenge is those kinds of contracts, whether they're support services or what, are not the real overrun kinds of contracts in IT. I mean, so because we can predict what it might cost to do support services, but in your first story, the opening paragraph was a 4-year effort to build a system, and now the contractor has been told to go home, right? And those are the real cost overruns. When a system that a contractor was contracted to build with unclear requirements over many years, now it's orders of magnitude more expensive.
Are you seeing, Jason, any changes to the ways that agencies are writing the requirements? Because Tim's not the first person and not the only person in industry and certainly not the only person even in government to say the requirements process is really a problem.
That has definitely been a longstanding challenge, and it's not going to go anytime soon. And I think part of the move to agile development, part of the move to away from the Big Bang Theory is because of that reason. Well, what can we do? Well, we need to do piece X. Okay, mm-hmm. Let's just work on piece X and not worry about piece Y and piece Z,
yeah.
Even though we do need it. We're going to do it, and that's where I think that move is coming from. The other piece of it is the training and the focus on the acquisition workforce is the other reason why because part of it is the requirements definition. And not with the budget deficit, again, I'm going to go back to that, and the discretionary spending, the training, the acquisition workforce increases are all going to get hit pretty hard by the freezes or the decreases in discretionary spending.
And so your reference to agile methodologies, this is the one thing. Sorry, I don't want you to hear us not being a fan of fixed price contracting because we think it's great if the requirements can be, if everybody can agree on what needs to be built. But we also do want to help our customers move toward these more flexible software development lifecycle methodologies like Agile. And sometimes those are in conflict. So one of the things we've been doing more and more is doing fixed prices for an amount of work to be delivered, not necessarily a particular deliverable.
Mm-hmm.
And when we can clearly define how much stuff can get done with that amount of work, which is really more of an agile kind of way of looking at mm-hmm. things, then we can strike a happy middle ground. And it's really proven to be quite effective.
Jason Miller, story number 2 on the countdown is headlined, Agencies Slowly Moving to Fixed Price Contracts. And you can read it at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. Story number 2 on the countdown from Tim Hext when In-Depth continues on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
Do you know us? You count on our technology every day. The office elevator that takes you up and down efficiently. The jet engine that gets you home safely. The fire suppression system you hope you never need, but know is there. You count on things we make to protect you from harm, and even to keep you cool and comfortable. Our technologies are a critical part of your everyday life. Yet many people don't even know who we are. Our name is United Technologies. We are Carrier, Hamilton Sunstrand, Otis, Pratt & Whitney, Sikorsky, and UTC Fire and Security. Six businesses united as one powerful company. In fact, we are one of the largest manufacturers in the United States, which likely makes us the biggest company you've never heard of, even though you depend on us every single day. United Technologies. Get to know more about us at UTC.com.
When every moment matters and a hand reaches out, when someone gives blood and a life is saved, that moment when heartbreak turns to hope, you're there through the American Red Cross. Every day, the Red Cross responds to nearly 200 neighborhood emergencies, and your support makes it possible. Use this moment to join us today. Visit redcross.org.
Engineers have come up with a new way to deliver cancer-fighting medicines. They're disguising them as red blood cells. Sending drugs into the body to fight cancer is truly like a combat mission. If detected, the immune system destroys the medicines in minutes. But if they can
stay longer in the system, they will have a longer time to circulate in the bloodstream to find the diseased cells or the tumor size.
Liangfeng Zheng, a University of California San Diego engineer, says a good camouflage helps. So he's wrapping tiny drugs, called nanoparticles, with a red blood cell membrane cloak, either from matching blood bank types or better.
You can actually collect the blood from the patient himself. And then you use these blood cells to make the nanoparticles.
Such disguised drugs lasted in mice for almost 2 days. More at www.nae.edu/radio. With the National Academy of Engineering, Randy Atkins, Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
Hi, this is O'Donna Matthews. What does 3 decades of service add up to? For the Capital Area Food Bank, it includes these important numbers. Distributing 25 million pounds of food to nearly 500,000 people through a network of 700 partner agencies. 30 years, it's a long time, but the mission continues to make sure that no one is left hungry. To learn more, contribute, or volunteer, visit CapitalAreaFoodBank.org.
We're back on In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. It's the Federal News Countdown. With Jason Miller, my colleague here at Federal News Radio, and Tim Hext of AgileX. And Tim, your story number two is from NextGov, Joseph Marx's story, National Archives First Wikipedian in Residence to Bring More Holdings to the Public. This is kind of a weird, brave new world we're in, I guess, where Wikipedia has gone from just a couple of years ago having this reputation for being not reliable. You didn't know if you could necessarily count on what was there. It was kind of real spotty as far as the information that was available, to a position where the National Archives thinks it's significant enough and embedded enough in people's internet experience that they want to be a part of it and be a contributor to it.
Well, that's absolutely one of the reasons this intrigued me a bit. The perception about crowdsourcing kinds of systems like Wikipedia, that they are not reliable because anybody can change them, is something that, frankly, is more, in my opinion, has always been a bit more perception than reality, and mm-hmm. has frustrated me. My daughter is in the public elementary school in Virginia and working on research. They're teaching them how to do research, and they're told they cannot use Wikipedia. Mm-hmm. It's okay if they use my summer trip to Williamsburg.com as a source, but it's not Wikipedia, because Wikipedia can be edited by anybody. So they're allowed to use the internet at large, which, by the way, can be edited,
by anybody.
But they're not allowed to use Wikipedia, where the sources have college professors and photographs and document references. And so, yes, nothing is a perfect source, but even no encyclopedia is. So that always frustrated me. So this suggests to me a sign that the government is in some way legitimizing this by starting to have real National Archives data that they're going to distribute through this mechanism.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing that intrigued me about this story is we're seeing increasingly across government the adoption of commercial systems and infrastructure, whether it's mobile technologies or cloud-based infrastructures or what, where rather than building it themselves, and it would not have been long ago that the National Archives said, oh, we will build
our own wiki.
Big infrastructure for distributing our electronic content. In the end of the article, he said, yeah, we lost the competition to Google. When people go and search, they don't find our references. They find Google's references, mm-hmm. right? And so recognizing that, embracing it, making sure it's done in a secure way, in a cost-effective way, in a way that serves the government's constituency is important. But I like that trend.
I'm not going to ask you to speak for the National Archives, but as a okay. technology person, is that a hard hurdle to jump over to say, we're not doing this maybe the way we would prefer to, but we'll live with the real world the way that it is and work within the confines and advantages that are available to us now?
It's hard for the government in a couple of ways. Some is the perceived loss of control over their system. You know what? Wikipedia is good, but it doesn't do exactly what we need. So mm-hmm. we better build a system that does exactly what we need. Or heaven forbid, what if Wikipedia is down and somebody wants to get something from the National Archives? And so there's this sense that they have to turn over control.
Mm-hmm.
Second, and clearly this is important in government, there's a security concern sometimes. Maybe with this, it's not as big a deal because this is, while it is government, these materials are managed by the government, they are the people's data.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's okay that we publish them this way, whereas it might be quite different if the Social Security Administration decided to host a system on the Amazon cloud. It's very different implications
right.
when it comes from security perspective. So mm-hmm. that's often a big inhibitor or an inhibitor, a roadblock in how quickly they move into adopting these sort of commercial infrastructures. But that tidal wave is coming quick,
mm-hmm.
and we're seeing it every day, an increase in this kind of adoption.
Tim used the word perceived loss of control too, Jason, and I think that's really all it is anymore because there really isn't any control. You and I talked about this not too long ago from the context of exclusives in the news business, and to some degree, there's not we can't control that anymore because if somebody that competes with Federal News Radio gets something, we can post it and, of course, giving them full credit for it. But, I mean, everybody knows what everybody else is doing, and there's right. not really such a thing anymore, I don't think.
What's interesting about this story as well is certain agencies, and I think NARA is one of them, I think there's a handful of others, GSA comes to mind, are really taking that leap into the abyss of social media. And I mean that in a very positive way in the sense that they're saying we're going to give up some control. We're going to realize that we're going to meet the way that the public expects to reach us and not just the way we think the public should reach us. And I think this is a perfect example of NARA saying, well, people are using Wikipedia. People are going to the internet to find stuff. We need to be there, and we need to be there in a way that people are used to it. And I think that's positive. Now, I think the biggest issue, and I think you brought it up very well, is the government has a higher responsibility, I think, than the average public company or public provider of information in that when you go to the government, you go to a site that is a government site, you expect that information to be correct or as correct as humanly possible.
Mm-hmm.
So if you go to a Wikipedia-type site and something's incorrect and you know it's incorrect, it calls into question everything else. And the government's very aware of that issue, and I think that's why it's a slow roll compared to what's happening in the private sector.
But it also reinforces what Tim is saying about the significance of this. If the government's willing to say this is good enough for us to be associated with, understanding that that's the standard, then that kind of underlines the significance of what Tim's talking about too.
Well, and it begins to educate people of the reality of how sites like this work, which
mm-hmm.
is, yes, erroneous things get put on and then the collective corrects the errors. And maybe now we'll have some folks who are legitimately responsible for a given bit of information in there, making sure things are kept up to date. But I would argue that errors on Wikipedia are corrected more quickly than they are on most any website because it has so many people trying to find those. And so beginning to have some trust in that is not a bad thing.
The term that I've heard used is the wisdom of the crowd.
Right.
And the idea that there are, as you say, there are so many eyeballs that somebody is going to know, wait a minute, and be able to cry foul and make something.
Well, it
make
also
changes to something.
It also recognizes the reality that the old sources are not necessarily better. So Stanford, I think, did a study, I want to say maybe 2 years ago, where they compared Wikipedia content to the traditional encyclopedia content, and it was by and large more accurate mm-hmm. and certainly more timely.
Yeah.
And so
it's funny because my parents were cleaning out the house not too long ago and came across the encyclopedia set that, I mean, not 15, 20 years ago cost almost $1,000, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And what do you do with them? I mean, they're just boat anchors at this point.
That's right.
It's really wild.
That's right.
Tim Hecht's story number two is from NextGov. The headline is National Archives First Wikipedian in Residence to Bring More Holdings to the Public. And you can find it at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. Coming up, number one, stories of the week. The most important federal news stories of the week is chosen by Jason Miller and Tim Hecht. We'll be back to hear them on In-Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
NBC News Radio, I'm Luke Russert. Up against the clock, President Obama says Congress still has the time to do the big deal, cutting the deficit while raising the debt ceiling. But time is running out.
We should not even be this close to a deadline on this issue. This should have been taken care of earlier. But it is encouraging that everybody believes that this is something that has to be addressed.
August 2nd is the critical date when the U.S. will default on its loans unless the debt ceiling is raised. Last month, consumer prices overall fell for the first time in a year. Chalk it up to a steep drop in gas costs. U.S. women could make history Sunday. After rocketing through the world's best competitors, the American World Cup soccer team is only one match away from the first World Cup championship since 1999. NBC's Ann Thompson is in Frankfurt, Germany, where the match will take place.
What the United States brings to the game is heart and this never-say-die attitude.
I'm Luke Russert, NBC News Radio.
If you drive a pre-owned GM vehicle and you've never pushed the blue OnStar button on your rearview mirror, now is the time to do it. Because right now, if you're not a current OnStar subscriber, you can try 3 months of OnStar free with no obligation. Push the blue button and tell the advisor you want automatic crash response, help in an emergency, navigation, and more. Offer available on 2006 and newer digitally equipped GM models. Push the button now or visit OnStar.com for coverage map, details, and system limitations. OnStar. Live on.
Could switching to GEICO really save you 15% or more on car insurance? If a tree falls in the forest and no one is around, does it make a noise?
Yep. Be like the 4 million who switched to GEICO last year, and you too could start saving money. For a free rate quote, visit GEICO.com to see how much you could save. 15 minutes could save you 15% or more on car insurance.
Newsmakers on the Federal Drive with Tom Tamman and Amy Morris, weekday mornings 6 to 10.
Blake Hall, the co-founder and CEO of TroopSwap.
We found that many businesses that wouldn't offer deals on Groupon or Living Social will offer deals to the military community. And we've also found that oftentimes the businesses that would offer them on other sites will offer them at better prices for our community because they want to give back.
Hear the entire interview online, federalnewsradio.com/Federal Drive.
This is the Federal News Countdown on In-Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Tim Hecht of Agilex and Jason Miller of Federal News Radio have chosen the three most important federal news stories of the week, according to them, ranked them in order from number three to number one, and we're counting them down. And, of course, they're available for you to read anytime you want it. federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. We are up to
number one.
The most important news story of the week, as chosen by Tim Hecht of Agilex, is from Politico. The headline is Tech Experts Exit White House. And later on in the show this afternoon, we're going to have some of the highlights of Vivek Kundra testifying before Congress just yesterday. His departure is imminent, going to Harvard. What are your thoughts, Tim, as you're seeing him depart? There are some other folks that have left the administration, too. It's not abnormal. It's about that right, about the right time in an administration for that to happen.
Yeah, it is. And I think it's about the right time for the life cycle of a tech person who maybe came from outside or from a different venue and has gotten embroiled in things and can only last so long in that environment. But what struck me about this is when this administration took over, there was a fever pitch conversation about the importance of technology and the role, and starting even during the campaign when they leveraged technology in a whole new way. And that was exciting. We would bring that into government. And I must admit, when Vivek's position was first established, I gave a little eye rolling, like, yeah, how much effect is the federal CIO really going to have on all the big systems and programs that go on? But he's had an impact. And we see a lot of organizations that are saying, oh, yeah, we're updating our cloud strategy because it's one of the 25 points. And, you know, they're actually moving in 2 years, right, moving in response to his unending drumbeat of cloud and mobile and agile and things that are good for for this part of the government. And so as they leave in this part of the administration's life cycle, and this article is about how there are lots of people leaving, I hope it doesn't mark a lack of continued enthusiasm for having leaders that are important in these parts of the discussion. And it tends, maybe there's a bit now of a distraction about elections coming up and more political issues. And then once that drumbeat stops, you have to sort of start it all over again.
Jason, you cover these people, Vivek in particular, but the other folks that are mentioned in this article on a day-to-day basis. And I don't think anybody would disagree with Tim's statement that he's really, Vivek in particular, has been a driver, and agencies are really going where he wants them to go. Are they going because they understand his vision, or are they going kicking and screaming, or does it even matter?
Yes. There you go. Or no, it doesn't matter. I guess a couple things I would say. One of the things Vivek Kundra did when he first came in, and he gets a lot of credit for, is he didn't just come up with a plan and a strategy and says, this is what we're going, and I know everything. He actually talked to the CIO Council and said to them, what do we need to do? Where do we need to go? In fact, the 25-point plan, a lot of that has been something that's been talked about for a long time. And the CIO Council brought up, here's the stuff we think in the short and long, medium term, meaning 6 to 18 months, we need to fix, and we need to fix now. Stuff like cloud, stuff like mobile strategies, but also stuff like program management. Going back to the requirements definition discussion we had earlier, that stuff has been a problem for years. So now there's a plan around it. I think so much focus from the last administration was on cybersecurity, and rightly so. That was the biggest priority, the biggest issue. Vivek, in some ways, and he's gotten some... He got some disparagement for his lack of focus on security. Yes, there's Howard Schmidt, but Howard Schmidt's been very focused outside of the government, public-private partnerships. But Vivek's, I think, to the point where agencies feel better about their security. They by no means are secure, but they feel better about security, where it's going, why they understand it. So now they give them the opportunity to work on other things. And as the evolution change of cloud and data, which is leads right into mobility, I think that's where it's going to go. And just to get back to Tim's point real quick, even when Vivek leaves, all this is going to continue, because whoever replaces him, I think, is not going to be the visionary person. It's going to be the doer, get this implemented over the next year, because that's all the time potentially the administration has. Now, obviously, President Obama gets reelected, and you know the what goes from there. But I think that a lot of this stuff is going to continue whether he's there or not, because people get it, and it's their ideas.
Well, I think this is our opportunity to say, I hope that's true. And this is our chance to say, wait a minute, is there a tempo change in the prioritization of these kinds of issues? And that's really the reason I like the story. The people that come in, the doing doesn't happen with them. The doing happens in the agencies. But they have been, in a way that I have not seen, rallying behind some common themes. And I think that has come from having a seat at the table in the dialogue with a lot of these technology issues, which in the past have not been at this table. And so my point is only, I believe you're right. I hope you're right. But it's a good time to remind everybody that we need to make that so.
I'm asking this question not to be provocative, but because I honestly don't know. Is there any significance to the fact that Vivek announced his departure, what now, a month or so ago? And we're not even really hearing many names in the rumor mill as far as who would replace him, let alone somebody to actually replace him.
There's plenty of names in the rumor mill.
Well, but we heard a couple when he first announced he was leaving, and then I haven't at least heard much since then.
But that's because if you are among the people who are being interviewed, it's not a good thing for you to go out and talk about it.
No, of course not.
So that's why it's a very... The people who have been interviewed are only telling the most trusted people, if they're telling anybody. And I think that's why it's going to get real quiet. And then as it gets closer, once they've made a decision or have a finalist or two or three, that's when it'll start to pick back up. And Vivek has said, you know, we want somebody in place. The president would like someone in place before I go, so there's a little bit of overlap. So you could hear a new person named in the next couple of weeks.
All right, so let's have a pool. What's the date? I'm not going to ask you for a name, but a date that you think that his replacement will be named.
I will go August 10th. It's
August
a Wednesday.
10th, Jason.
I'll take the under on that.
No, it's not over under. You pick a date. Whoever gets closest wins.
It's not like Price is Right if he goes over.
No. No, this is not the...
What do we win?
Well, I'll tell you later.
I will say, so that's a Wednesday. I'm going to say it's that Monday.
So August 8th.
August 8th.
Okay.
Okay, and I'm going to go with, I'll just take August 9th, just to crowd you both out.
Can I add one quick point?
Sure.
This isn't just about Vivek, because you're right, he's going and he's the high-profile one that's going. It's about the role of technology, the prioritization of technology, the prioritization of basic science now that NASA's maybe going to be in a whole kind of new mission. These issues just, I think, are important to keep at the forefront of the dialogue. And as people rearrange their chairs, we want to make sure that we keep that tempo going.
And real quick, but I was just at this Association of Government Accountants conference.
Mm-hmm.
You think government accountants, they were having abacus races down the hallway, but they weren't. Everything we talked about
I'd
at
like
that conference.
I'd like to see
that. Yeah, well, almost everything that was talked about at the conference had a technology piece to it.
Great.
There's no way that technology cannot anymore be at the forefront of what everyone's thinking about because of the role it plays in everything we do.
That's terrific. The biggest smile I've seen you have all day, Tim,
terrific.
When Jason says that.
That's true.
The story number one from Tim Hext on the Federal News Countdown is from Politico. The headline is Tech Experts Exit White House, and you can read it on federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. Jason Miller's story number one is next on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
Meeting mission goals through technology, brought to you by General Dynamics Information Technology.
The Department of Veterans Affairs says starting this October, its employees will be able to bring their own tablet computers and other mobile devices to work and use them on VA networks. For now, VA isn't saying specifically which devices they'll approve, only hinting that they'll be very popular devices. The department says it'll set up a secure system that allows those devices to view information on VA's electronic health record system, but not to store that data. Employees will also have to agree to let VA monitor the devices.
General Dynamics Information Technology is dedicated to providing the latest, highest quality information technology services and resources to help organizations meet their mission objectives. Large-scale IT systems and communications networks are the strategic and operational heart of defense, intelligence, civilian government, and private business. They require the expertise of a company that delivers results. General Dynamics Information Technology. Information technology and professional services. Go to GDIT.com to learn more. That's GDIT.com.
Profile America, Friday, July 15th. One of the biggest clam festivals in the country gets underway today and runs through Sunday in Yarmouth, Maine. Now in its 46th year, the lure of their favorite seafood delicacy is expected to draw 120,000 people to the coastal town, normally home to just over 8,000 people. The 3 days will be packed with events, including a fun run, a kayak race, and a chance to win a new car. The big parade has a theme this year of great American inventions. Of course, the star of the show will be clams, lots of them. The annual clam catch in recent years has ranged up to 118 million pounds, with a value of close to $200 million. You can find these and more facts about America from the U.S. Census Bureau online at census.gov. Medicare.gov.
Things just don't happen. You need a plan. A federal career can last 30 years or more, and so can federal retirement. Tune in each Monday at 10 a.m. to get the information you need to plan your course for financial security, solid benefits, and optimum health care. 100% focused on the federal employee for your benefit, presented by NITP, has the answers to your mid-career and retirement planning questions. Listen to For Your Benefit, Mondays at 10 a.m. on 1500 a.m. Federal News Radio for an hour that can change your future.
Young, gov, and awesome? Join 500 federal emerging leaders at the only conference created by and for younger feds. The next generation of government summit presented by young government leaders and GovLoop takes place July 28th and 29th at the JW Marriott. Federal News Radio listeners, save on registration. Use the discount code FEDRADIO to save $55. Visit nextgengovt.com.
Thanks for listening to In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. The Federal News Countdown includes the three most important federal news stories of the week as chosen by Tim Hecht of AgileX and my colleague Jason Miller from Federal News Radio. And Jason, your story number one is our DOD reporter Jared Serbu's story titled DOD Cyber Strategy Aims at Deterrence. And we'll hear from Deputy Secretary Bill Lynn also later on in the program talking about this at a news conference yesterday. 24,000 files in March stolen from the DOD network. And this cyber strategy aimed at deterrence, as the headline says, is already some people commenting about the whole deterrence factor and what it really means.
I think the reason why I picked this story as my top story is for, I think, two reasons. For what it is, which is a cyber strategy from the Defense Department, which is a fairly huge deal, but also for what it wasn't, which was it was pretty light. I mean, I think there's a lot of criticism that came out right away. Congressman Jim Langevin, the Democrat from Rhode Island, said, listen, there's a lot of questions you just didn't answer in here. And even the industry said, well, yeah, these are all good things, but what are you talking about for real? Mm-hmm. I was less taken aback by the 24,000 files stolen. That's, in many ways, it's new news because it just happened in March, but in many ways, it's old news. DOD admitted back in 2005, 2006, that they were losing terabytes of data every month. Mm-hmm. So 24,000 files, maybe Tim can tell us how much that actually is. Doesn't seem like a lot compared to terabytes of data that DOD was saying was being exfiltrated. Thank you. Uh-huh. Out of their system. But what was significant overall about this story is the fact is you have a strategy. We know it's been a priority. Now here it is in paper, and here's how we're going to address this stuff. It also leaves the door open for offensive capabilities. DOD has never fully admitted that they have offensive capabilities. I think we all can assume they do to a certain extent. But this leaves some doors open to some other questions and some very interesting, next steps for DOD.
I talked not too long ago to someone in the technology world in the intelligence community, and I said, you can't tell me that we don't have the capability to do the same things to, say, a country like China that a country like China is trying to do to us. And while he nodded his head yes, he said, I'm not going to comment on that. And that was off the record even. He didn't want his name attached to even that. So, but I don't think there's anybody that figures that possibility is not available, right, Tim?
He shakes his head yes and says he can't comment on that.
I'm neither shaking nor nodding.
No, to be fair, that's correct. You're declining to respond to that question, and that's fair.
I think what's interesting to me about this article is it talks a lot about the deterrence factor, so we can now consider a cyber attack as an act of war, mm-hmm. that we can retaliate with our full might. But to whom is that a deterrent? So nation states that may or may not be doing this against us, are they now saying, if we get caught, we might get attacked by the U.S. military? Maybe. But the broad community, there's been a lot of cyber attacks in the news lately in and around Anonymous and other organizations. They are not symmetrical threats. And mm-hmm. so... to whom are we going to deliver our massive weapons?
Who do you bomb when Anonymous happens?
And so to what extent is it a viable deterrent? I like the idea of us stepping up and saying, look, we now consider this just as bad as the other kinds of attacks you might have. And because what my analogy is the same with terrorism, there might be physical attacks, and that yet there's no necessarily nation state to attack.
But remember, what they're saying is a deterrence is not necessarily we're going to bomb you. But we have, I think the U.S. as a military has some pretty significant abilities in the cyber warfare. And one of the interesting things, I had a conversation with some friends of mine who are techies, and I didn't realize this, but they said there was a lot of big in the blogosphere that the Stuxnet virus, there's a lot of belief that was a U.S. implanted virus with the help of other countries. But that's just an example of if the U.S. really wants to go after you, I think that's an example of they can do it. And I think what the strategy says is, oh, by the way, not only we can do this, this gives us the path to do it.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're taking off the gloves. And one glove is, in fact, our traditional military strength. But like I said, I think that only applies when we can point at a nation state. That's why all the articles are really referencing this particular case where we really think it was another state, whatever. Mm-hmm. And the other glove is now we are legitimizing the use of these cyber techniques as a retaliatory technique. If you use them against us, we'll use them against you, and you should assume we're good at this, right?
Exactly.
So I think I like the idea that we're no longer pretending that we're just going to treat cyber like you hacked into our email. This is hacking the U.S.
Much more serious and much more specific with the way they're going to do. Now, what they're going to do, you don't know, but they're going to respond.
Jason Miller, story number one is our Jared Serbu story, headlined DOD Cyber Strategy Aims at Deterrence. It's still linked up on the homepage at federalnewsradio.com, and it's also on the in-depth page on our website. Gentlemen, a terrific Federal News Countdown. Thank you very much for being on today. Tim Hex of Agilex and Jason Miller, I appreciate your time. It's a fun time as always.